Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
...52 years. I still have people now and then that remember me, asking me if whatever happened to my sister, did I ever find out, you know. And I told a couple recently, I told them to spread the word what I thought happened to her. Usually when we went for a walk, we walked together. I just, that one time, I didn't feel like walking down the tracks because she wanted to go back to the pond that we hang out and dig up a muskrat with the dog. And I didn't go with her. I know that she had got there. I saw what the dog had dug the hole. So I said I backtracked where she had walked. And I guess when she came back from what she was doing, that's when she got nabbed. That day I didn't go.
On July 11th, 1969, 15-year-old Cynthia Constantine took her dog for a walk, as she did every afternoon in the family's hometown of Oakdale, New York. Cynthia loved to walk along the railroad tracks that ran along a busy highway and often explored the area with her brother. On this day, Cynthia walked her dog alone, picking up cattails along the way. But Cynthia never returned home, and when the family dog came home without her, the family immediately knew that something was wrong. Backtracking her steps, Cynthia's mother and brother found a pile of cattails that Cynthia had likely collected and dropped. And this is a spot that Cynthia is believed to have vanished from more than 53 years ago and has never been seen or heard from again. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 356 of The Vanished, Cynthia Constantine's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices and audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Oakdale, New York is a centuries-old town, a hamlet within the town of Islip that dates back to 100 years prior to the American Revolution. The town sits on the southern edge of Long Island and has always relied upon fishing, boating, and other seaside industries throughout its long history. In the 1960s, Oakdale was still in the post-war era of development, and much growth was seen in the area, which felt like more of a small town than the busyness of Long Island and the New York City metropolitan area. In fact, in 1969, statistical records indicate that the New York City area had a population of 16 million people, whereas Oakdale had a population of about 7,300 residents, which has remained nearly unchanged in the last 50 years. It was in this environment that Cynthia Constantine and her family lived. Her parents owned a bicycle shop not far from their house, and she and her brother William grew up there. So this many years later, William is the only family member who is still alive, and he continues to look for Cynthia at 70 years old, hoping to find her before no one else is left to look. We spoke with William for this story after he reached out to us earlier this year, so we could help him tell his sister's story. We asked him to give us some background on his family first.
We moved there from Bethpage, Long Island. My mother lived in Connecticut and Brooklyn, New York, and the Bronx. And my father lived in Floral Park, Long Island. So they met, I guess, in a special dance for military men. He had been in the Army and got out, and he was coming to one of those dances, and that's how they met. They moved to Bethpage when they got married, and then my father wanted his own business. He was an aircraft mechanic for United Airlines, and he was also an aircraft mechanic for Grumman. And he wanted to start his own business, and he couldn't do it in Bethpage, so he found a place in Oakdale, which was a junkyard at one time, and made a bicycle business out of it and a motorcycle business. And he still had to go to work because it didn't pay. My mother had to go to work because the taxes were rising up faster than they could keep up with it.
So many years later, it's nearly impossible to find information about Cynthia and who she was. There was no internet, social media, and there were very few news articles about Cynthia's disappearance that gave us the insight of others before they passed away. Most of the times that we came across Cynthia's name in the media, it was in a brief mention about teenage runaways, which we will come back to. There were a few stories that we came across in which Charlotte Constantine, Cynthia and William's mother, spoke to reporters. Charlotte has since passed away, so uncovering her words brought her grief and heartbreak back to life for us. And we were able to learn more about Cynthia and the Constantine family. One piece, written by Lou Lawrence and published 2 days prior to the one-year anniversary of Cynthia's disappearance in the Suffolk County News, read as follows. Mrs. Charlotte Constantine is a sad but composed woman with a kind face and soft voice. The Constantine family lived in Oakdale for 14 years. Her husband Robert Constantine had hoped to build his bicycle shop into a successful business. For this reason, they continued to live on the busy Montauk Highway, despite Mrs. Constantine's objections. She feels that this limited the children's freedom a great deal while they were growing up. The dangers involved with the heavy flow of traffic on the highway prevented Cynthia and her brother William from visiting or being visited by neighboring children when they were younger. The result was that the children had few friends and were shy and perhaps too sheltered from the world around them. Mrs. Constantine explained that Cynthia might have been considered a square by other teenagers. She wasn't interested in rock and roll. She had no boyfriends. She was helpful around the house. She enjoyed swimming at the local pool. She and her mother had good times together at the beach. They quite often went to the movies. She enjoyed playing the organ she received at Christmas from her parents. She liked to play happy music, her mother added quite sadly. She had few girlfriends. At one time, she had found a new friend. They had attended a few church dances together. Her mother had been pleased to see her becoming more sociable. Mrs. Constantine believes that Cynthia was just coming out of her shell before her disappearance. She was doing well in school. She seemed happy. Charlotte went on to describe Cynthia more intimately to the reporter. Cynthia might be called a square by some, but I think she might be best described as a sweet, sensitive girl. She enjoyed nature and loved animals. She spent hours walking through the woods with her dog. Her brother would join her on her nature walks. She had several pets in her backyard. Her pet rabbits were faithfully fed and cared for. She devoted most of her time to studying and caring for her animals. She enjoyed drawing and reading. We thought that using a direct quote from Charlotte was the best way to share her own words, because we had to rely solely on William's account and memory of his sister so that we could tell her story. That story seems to have nearly vanished along with her, until now, when William shared Cynthia with us and honored her life by giving her her voice back and telling us what is also his own story that he's lived the majority of his life with. This is what he told us about who his sister was and what she was like.
She was shy. She wasn't a fighter. She couldn't really defend herself if she wanted to. She loved animals. She was great at artwork. She was a member of the Lutheran Church. She went there and got confirmation, Lutheran Church in Sable. She was a brownie in the little brownies thing at one time. She was doing good in school. She would have been a great artist if she was alive today. She was a good kid. It was just the two of us. I think she wanted to be an artist. She also liked music, so she had an organ. She used to play in the house, a small one. She loved music. Yeah, you know, my sister didn't have too many friends, maybe one or two. She got picked on a lot because, you know, that's what kids do. I mean, you know, if you're weak, they pick on you. She liked, you know, having friends. So it was not no introverted, but just that where we lived, it wasn't easy to go to anybody's house because they were so far away. I know she liked the boy, but it wasn't a boyfriend. I didn't know the boy's name. My mother probably would know, but can't talk to her now.
William told us that growing up in the late 50s and throughout the 60s, he and Cynthia spent much of their time outdoors, the way many children did in the decades before cable television, video games, and the internet.
We were born on Long Island, and we grew up there. We loved exploring. We loved finding wild animals, whatever we can find, whatever we can see. That was our thing, because there was nothing else to do. We were fascinated by nature. That's why, you know, when she wanted to go back with the dog and dig up the animal, you know, because our Labrador, we had a black Labrador, would go after any animal. She would take the dog, and I would go with her many times. We would go down, because we loved being in the woods. We went to Byron Lake. It used to be called Second Pond years ago, before it was Byron Lake. And we would walk there, but we'd always went together as a group, my mother and my sister and myself. She would never go there by herself. It's just across the street from the house, and she'd walk down to a place that we used to call the spot where the muskrat was. It used to be a skating pond. We called it Okie Pinokie Swamp. That's what all the kids in the neighborhood called it. The body of water that we used to go skating on is where my sister was digging up the muskrat. That now has a building on it. That's all filled in. There's no more pond there. It's all filled in.
On July 11th, 1969, Cynthia wanted to go for her usual afternoon walk with her Labrador named Girl. Earlier, Cynthia had spotted a muskrat burrow and wanted to go back and check it out. William didn't feel like going on this particular day, a decision that he has spent his entire life wishing he could go back and change. Instead, Cynthia went alone with the dog, and several hours later, she still hadn't returned. William and Cynthia's mother came home from work and asked where Cynthia was, but William said she'd been gone for over an hour. And then when Girl, the Labrador, returned home soaking wet but without Cynthia, they knew something was wrong and immediately went to the police. William told us that one of the first things he did was follow the trail he knew his sister would take, as it was a well-traveled route for the two teens. He believed that Cynthia was abducted and that he knows exactly where, but remains puzzled even today by the fact that no one saw anything. Or at least no one reported seeing anything.
Usually when we went for a walk, we walked together. That one time, I didn't feel like walking down to the tracks because she wanted to go back to the pond that we hang out and dig up a muskrat with the dog. And I didn't go with her. I know that she had got there. I saw what the dog had dug the hole. So I said I backtracked where she had walked. And I guess when she came back from what she was doing, that's when she got nabbed. The thing that really bothers me back in those days is where she got abducted, because I backtracked her footsteps. I found out where she picked the cattails for me. I found out where she walked. She had the dog with her. And the very spot on the railroad tracks where she dropped the cattails is a spot where I think they either coerced her into the vehicle or they just grabbed her and put her in a vehicle or whatever they did. And that spot can be seen from the overpass bridge. Cars were going over that bridge at that time of day. It was during rush hour because she had left around, I guess, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, somewhere around that time, whatever that time was. And cars, traffic starts building up on that bridge because there used to be a traffic light at the other end of it. Somebody saw something from the road and never came forward because that was headline news back then. They had it in the newspapers about her. It went on for about a week straight and everybody knew about it. So somebody saw something and never came forward because nobody wanted to get involved back then. Police went around the neighborhood asking people if they saw anything. Nobody said anything. And I was told people knew something happened there or they saw something or whatever and never came forward.
The family dog Girl had returned home without Cynthia, which was certainly strange and alarming to her family.
The dog name was Girl. She wandered into our property. Full-grown dog. She hung around with us, and then we finally accepted her as one of our own, and we had her for about, I guess, 3 or 4 years. Dog came back without her. The dog came back wet, all on the bottom, because I know the dog, she had gotten the dog in the swamps, and that's where she went to get the cattails. So the dog came back wet, panting like crazy. The dog crossed the busy highway. I don't know how that she did it, but she did it. She got home, and then, you know, we're like, well, where's Cynthia? And that's what my mother said, you know, where's Cynthia? So we took the dog with us, to go back across the tracks. And, you know, the dog we had, the Labrador, was scared of its own shadow. It wouldn't have defended her in any way. It's just the nature of the dog. It was a Labrador, black Labrador.
William retraced Cynthia's steps many times. But on the day she vanished, he and his mother went together to walk that well-worn path. And he shared with us something that happened on that walk that he has rarely told anyone.
When my mother came home from work, she was a nurse in a hospital in Brookhaven. When she came home from work, she said, "Where's your sister?" I said, "Well, she went for a walk with the dog." And my mother says, "Well, she knows she's not supposed to go across that street without anybody, by herself." I said, "Well, she's been gone an hour." I think I said that. You know, my memories faded a lot from that time. The odd thing is, and I haven't told this to too many people. In fact, I only told my wife. When I was walking back with my mother that night that she disappeared, we walked back on the tracks, and we were walking back. I heard my sister yell, "Help." I heard her voice as clear as day, but my mother didn't hear it. And my mother's hearing was just as good as mine. And I don't know why she didn't hear it, but I heard the call for help. And it sounded like it came from the woods, but there was nothing there. And the fact that she didn't hear it, I didn't pursue it any further because I thought maybe it was a couple of kids were playing across the street fighting and maybe it sounded like my sister. I don't know. But it sure sounded like it. And some people say, "Well, you heard a spiritual call." I don't know what I heard, but I remember that help. I remember that yelling, "Help." But we immediately went across the street with the dog again, and we went back, and that's when we backtracked and we found what she did. I found the cattails, and we couldn't find her footprints anymore. I mean, we saw the dog scatter prints, like the dog was chased, but we didn't see her prints. So we walked along the road on the side of the tracks, and when we got down probably, I'd say about a quarter of a mile from where the railroad bridge was, that's where I heard the call for help. It was hard to tell where that help yell, that scream for help came from. It sounded clear as day. It was very clear. It sounded a good distance away, like maybe 300-400 feet. That sound has haunted me for years. But my mother didn't hear it. I don't know why she didn't hear it. I was the only one that heard it. My mother passed away in 2014. My father died in 92. And I lost all my cousins. They're all gone. So I'm the only one left in my family except for two cousins on my mother's side.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Thank you. Cynthia's parents reported her missing that very night. In the days that followed, search parties were organized by the Boy Scouts, fire department, and the church the family attended. They scoured the woods but turned up nothing. A July 31st article in the Suffolk County News said that the police had uncovered no leads since the morning of July 12th, when three small boys claimed to have seen Cynthia the night before, on the evening of her disappearance. They said they saw her enter the woods behind the Oakdale Railroad Station. The article also mentions that the police dragged Byron Lake and the swamp nearby to no avail. There was an article published about Cynthia in the Suffolk County News on July 17th. There's a small article next to the one about Cynthia titled Local Children Report Approaches, and it states the following. Two local youngsters were reported as having been approached by strange men this past week. It goes on to say that a mother reported that an unknown man stopped her 3-year-old son and bought him ice cream. And the mother of a 14-year-old girl told police that her daughter was stopped by an unknown male, who asked her to get into his car. The boy told his mother only that the man who stopped him was driving a black car. The girl reported that the man who approached her was white, about 30 years old, wore a brown suit, and was driving a red car. These incidents occurred during the week after Cynthia's disappearance. Is it possible that they could be connected? Or was the local community just on edge after Cynthia went missing, and were reporting anything that seemed slightly suspicious to the police? William has to rely solely on his own memories when talking about his sister. He hasn't been able to obtain any records or even verify that any exist. When we contacted law enforcement, we were told to come down to the precinct and search through their archives, and that was all we were told. William has very distinct memories, though, and remembers especially the first investigator assigned to Cynthia's case.
There's an original detective that spent the most time on the case. His name was Detective Santos. He retired some years back. I don't know if he's still alive today, but this fellow was in the Suffolk County Police Department, and he was with the 5th Precinct. Detective Santos retired in the 80s, I believe. A nice fella. He talked to me decently. He wasn't questioned me harsh like the rest of them did. And he came around a lot. One of those detectives questioned me and asked me if I had a sexual relationship with my sister. That really got me. That was really messed up. My response was, they looking at me like I'm guilty. The whole time, every police officer came. The only detective that was nice was Detective Santos. He was the only one who didn't grill me with stupid stuff like that. He was just trying to get as much info out of me as he could, trying to jog my memory and everything. And did I notice this? Did I see that? Did you see anybody hanging around the house? Did you see, stuff like that.
William was the last person to see Cynthia, so naturally he was a focus of the police investigation. But he was also a child himself, and there was no indication that he had done anything other than choose not to go on a walk with Cynthia and their dog. But the police seemed especially interested in him and his potential involvement in his sister's disappearance. William told us more about that.
I've had detectives come to my house like 10 years after the incident and go backtrack on everything. But at that time, the way they're trained, they were trying to trick question me because originally I was the number one suspect. At that time, we had some corrupt police in the police department, and there was corruption going on that I didn't know about. I was just a 17-year-old kid at the time. I didn't know nothing. I hadn't never been in trouble for anything. They had me on a lie detector. The whole story started when I was the last one to see her leave the house, and they questioned me about the time and everything, and they came back with two or three detectives, questioned me over and over and over again, checking my story over and over again. And then one day, they took me for a ride down to the tracks where my sister had dumped a bunch of cattails that she was carrying at that time. And I think that's where she was abducted, right at that location. They were digging up something dead. And they were questioning me while they were digging something up that was dead. Now, here I am, 17 years old, looking at this hole they're digging. I'm not listening to them questioning me at all. I'm just saying yes to everything they were talking to me. And I'm thinking to myself, are they digging up my sister? Or what are they, I was kind of in shock. So, of course, I answered all the questions wrong because I was saying yes to everything because I wasn't listening to them. So right away, oh, he's lying. They took me. They put me on a lie detector. I was so darn nervous being a 17-year-old kid, never being in trouble. I didn't fail it. It was inconclusive because I was so damn nervous that their instrument was all over the scale. And one of the detectives said, well, he doesn't seem too concerned. He seems kind of like he's hiding something, you know. I wasn't somebody that showed my emotions back then. I held everything in. When I was by myself, that's when the tears came out. But, you know, I didn't show my emotions that much. So they figured I was guilty of something, which was baloney. And they were useless. They followed me. That's all they did was follow me because I used to be into 10-speed riding. And that was my way of unwinding. I'd go on my bike and I'd just ride anywhere. And I would ride for miles and then come back home again. And they would follow me. They didn't think I saw them. Somebody was following me all the time. Every time I went on my bike, they thought my sister was hiding somewhere and I was going to where she was. That was their idea. You know, why is he riding his bike all over? Why is he doing that for? It wasn't a popular thing, bike riding back then. Not until the 10-speed craze started in the 70s.
William told us that it seemed like the police interrogation would never focus anywhere but him, but that there were other suspicious characters he felt they should be looking into, instead of wasting their time following him in circles.
I was brought inside, and they said to me, when you were walking the tracks with your sister, did you notice anybody watching you? And I said, yes. It was a fellow behind Tyler Boatcraft that had a shotgun, and he was watching us walk by. So they put a mugshot book in front of me, and they went through it, and they said, go through this to see if you recognize anybody. I picked them out of the mugshot, and I said, what did he do? They wouldn't tell me what he did. I never found out what kind of criminal record he had. But this guy said that the man was a peeping Tom, and there were incidents where he was peeking in people's windows. And my sister actually had said something before she disappeared that somebody was looking in her window at night, and she didn't see who it was, and he took off. Now, being this man owned a boat shop and had his own boat, I think whatever he did or whatever happened, I think he dumped my sister's body in the ocean. And the way I think that is because his last request to be buried was to be buried out past the Montauk Lighthouse in the ocean. You know, not for nothing, but I'm wondering if there's any trace of anything out in that ocean where he was buried, if there's a plastic bag that's sealed and her body could be still in, a cement block. I don't know.
William told us that he suspected this man that worked at or owned a place that manufactured boats, just across the highway from the Constantine's bicycle shop. He told us that Cynthia didn't know this person.
She did not know him. Well, we saw him, but we didn't know he was Tyler. We saw him once. I don't know if my sister saw him more than once, but usually when we went for a walk, we walked together. My father, I think maybe Tyler might have been a little younger than him. He might have been in his 50s at the time my sister disappeared, or his late 40s. And the other man might have been in his 40s. You know, that's what I'm guessing on age, by just seeing his face. I didn't know that this fellow Tyler had a record. He's the one that I suspect will kidnap my sister. That's who I suspect. He used to make sailboats. He's dead. He died in 2007. The fellow that gave me all this information used to live in Oakdale, too. His name was Tony LeBaire. And how he got this information is he overheard it from somebody saying they were talking about the story of my sister, and they knew who did it, and they said that he had an accomplice who was a member of the West Sable Fire Department. So the two of them got together and abducted my sister, tied to a cement block, and her body was tossed over. That's what he heard. And it sickens me because he didn't come forward all these years because he was into drugs. He was arrested, and he was locked up for 10 years in prison. I think he went to a California prison. And he owns his own business now. He has got a shop near the railroad tracks, near the Oakdale Railroad Station. And he told me if I were to mention his name to any police or any detectives, that he would deny that he ever said anything to me. He doesn't want no part of any police.
We don't know much about this man, Tony, who gave William information about this other man, Tyler. Could it be true that Tyler and an accomplice abducted Cynthia? Or are these simply rumors? William told us more about what Tony told him.
He said that there was a girl that was kidnapped by him, Tyler, and he had her on his boat, but she jumped off the boat and escaped and swam away. And he wanted to find this woman and talk to her about the incident because she never reported it. So I don't know who this woman is or what happened. And there was another incident where he had been peeping Tom in a window, and the wife of somebody screamed or something, or told her husband, and the husband was out to go after him afterwards. That was never reported to the police. I don't know what came of that. This guy's got a little criminal background. I just don't know exactly what they had him on and how he got away. What the detective said when they went to question him, Tyler, he wouldn't answer any questions. He refused everything. But they didn't pursue him. They didn't check his van. They didn't go after his boat. Nothing. That's what, you know, that's why I think he had something on the police at that time, and they were just pushing him aside.
William was the primary focus of the police, but the public scrutiny fell on his father, seemingly without reason given that he was at work and had a well-established alibi for the time frame in which Cynthia vanished. William told us that maybe it was because he wasn't able to express his grief at losing his only daughter in a way that the public felt was authentic or acceptable.
My father was a bit of a quiet man, but he would talk if you want to have a conversation with him. And lots of customers that came in with their bikes would always talk to him. Kind of a father he was. He showed me stuff, what to do and this and that. He spent more time working and trying to pay the bills, working out in the shop. And when the shop wasn't making enough money, he had to go back into his aircraft mechanics jobs. So he would be working at the airports and stuff. We would go on trips. We'd go to New Hampshire and stuff and little vacations. He was a good dad. I wouldn't say he was an abuser or nothing like that. He was good. And he loved my wife here, Teresa. He loved her. But he was a very good man. He would help anyone in need. He would help anyone, anybody. We had a little girl come to the shop once. She had a flat tire. She must have been like maybe 9 or 10 years old. And she was in tears because she thought she couldn't get home because she had a flat tire and she had no money. So my father says, I'll fix your bike. So I fixed the tire and fixed the flat. And she goes, I only have 3 cents in my pocket. And he goes, that's good. Give it to me. That's payment. And I go back home. And that woman contacted me years later on Facebook, and she never forgot that. She reminded me of what happened back then. But that's how my father was. And for people to say that he was involved, that was just a bad rumor. I've got to tell you, it was the first time I ever saw my father cry. He didn't like to show his emotions. And he just would cover his face and walk away, but I could tell he was crying. He was hurt over it. You know, he kept it to himself, but I could tell he was hurt over it. I don't remember how many times my father went out. I know my mother did quite a few times, and so did my sister's friend's parents. They went out and looked. They did, and so did a few other friends. They came out and volunteered to look. They had the Boy Scouts out, too. Things had to continue on. He had to pay the bills, so I think he was working. That's probably what my father was doing. He was burying himself in his work. I think he just thought she got grabbed. Somebody grabbed her and took off. That's what he believed.
William and Cynthia's father passed away without ever being publicly cleared by police. But there didn't seem to be any indication that he had involvement in her disappearance, or that law enforcement believed he did. We did see mention that he had replaced the flooring in his bicycle shop around the time Cynthia disappeared. But William said that the building his parents turned into a bicycle shop needed repairs, and that he doesn't remember anything suspicious or strange about the floors being replaced, like someone acting strangely or hauling away carpets in the middle of the night.
I don't think he was ever called down to the police station. You see, he had a solid alibi because he was working that day. He was at the airport.
Even when it seemed like the police wanted to only scrutinize William and his father, without taking a broader look at the case and the suspicious people William remembers, there seemed to be positive, unexpected turns in Cynthia's case. And while this one in particular didn't get the Constantine family any closer to answers, it felt good to know that someone with influence and authority took the time to acknowledge them.
Do you remember who was head of FBI back in the 60s? Hoover. My parents got a personal letter from him when they wrote to him about my sister being missing. So they wrote to the FBI, they wrote to Hoover, and he wrote back directly with his own handwriting. But they did get a message back. They were so happy to hear from him directly. You never get that from a politician, really. I mean, you get somebody's printed letter, and, you know, a copied signature, but you never get an actual letter and an actual signature.
We had to consider the possibility that Cynthia was a victim of a serial killer. And we know now that there was a good number of serial killers who were later found to have killed in the eastern United States during the 1960s and 70s. We dug into several, including Louis Lent, Charles Pierce, and others who had victims killed or found in the Northeast during the decades surrounding Cynthia's disappearance. Since we've learned that many serial killers kill for long periods of time before they're arrested. But there was one serial killer in particular, a name recognized by nearly everyone who's interested in true crime, who was closer to Oakdale at the time of Cynthia's disappearance. And William mentioned him to us, so we had to look into him a bit deeper.
Well, at one time, I thought that guy that went around killing those women all over, they used his body for science afterwards. It was in the news. He was famous. Ted Bundy. I thought maybe he had abducted her, and I had said that once to one of the detectives. I said, maybe it was him. I don't know.
There is no shortage of information on Ted Bundy, one of the most well-known and prolific serial killers in U.S. history. And though his first known victim wasn't killed until 1974, we couldn't overlook the fact that he was attending a university in Philadelphia in the spring semester of 1969. And Bundy is suspected in two unsolved murders of 19-year-old women in New Jersey on Memorial Day weekend in 1969, potentially placing Ted Bundy startlingly close to Cynthia, with both Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore being a short drive to New York. And Ted Bundy was known to travel to commit crimes. But the murder of the two women remains unsolved, and we may never know if there's a more concrete connection between any serial killer and Cynthia.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Police immediately labeled Cynthia a runaway. After all, she had left her home voluntarily for a walk, albeit with her dog, on what was nearly a daily ritual she and William undertook. She also left zero indication that she chose to leave and took nothing with her. We wish that we could say that this was simply the byproduct of antiquated policing, but unfortunately, it's still a practice police in the U.S. use every single day today, 53 years later. In fact, NCIC, the National Crime Information Center operated by the FBI, designates only three options for missing juveniles: abducted by a stranger, abducted by a non-custodial parent, and runaway. There are no other options. Why the designation continues to exist without an option that the child is in danger, which is true even of children who voluntarily run away from home, is a question we have never been able to find the answer to. And in Cynthia's case, William told us that he knows there's no chance Cynthia ran away by choice.
We had rabbits, pet rabbits, and they just had babies at that time. That's why when they said my sister was a runaway, I said, oh, no. She wouldn't leave those baby rabbits. I tell you, back then, nobody wanted to get involved. All you people that were volunteer, firemen and police department, you know, as far as the neighborhood, not many came out. Boy Scouts, maybe. That was about it. And I'll tell you why we didn't get the response. It's because back then it was the hippie movement. and kids were running away from home. They were flower children. And here's another thing. My sister had drawn a psychedelic drawing with flowers and that because the art teacher that she was under in school had them draw stuff like that. And so she had the picture hanging on the wall. So when the detectives came in, they looked at this, it was she a flower child? I said, no, she was not into the hippie movement. She was not into any of that stuff. She was not into drugs. She only had a few friends. She loved her animals. She kept to herself. She was quiet. And because of that time, there were so many runaways going on that they thought my sister was a runaway, being that we had no trace of her, nothing. And she left everything behind. She didn't take any money. There was nothing missing.
Cynthia was a 15-year-old girl in the late 1960s. It was entirely possible that she didn't even have a Social Security number issued to her yet, as she had never worked. How would she possibly have survived on her own? And why would she have wanted to run away and never speak to her family again? Why not reach out to William all of these years later, when her parents had passed, if she didn't want to have contact with them for some unknown reason? In our minds, it makes no sense to even consider Cynthia a runaway, especially with so many other possibilities at play. Still, her case remains classified as a runaway. As we mentioned previously, an outdated and dangerous term. William told us that there is still a detective assigned to Cynthia's case, but he's not sure that means he's doing anything to find her or answers as to what happened to her. Reflecting on Cynthia's disappearance 1 year after she went missing, the news article we shared with you earlier stated the following. Mrs. Constantine remained at home for many weeks hoping to hear from her daughter, or the kidnapper, or someone having information about Cynthia. They cannot believe that Cynthia ran away. Their arguments are sound. Why would a quiet, sensitive girl like Cynthia suddenly disappear one evening without money or a single belonging? Would a girl like Cynthia, with her deep affection for her animals, leave suddenly at a time when her pet rabbit was about to give birth? Would she have no regard for her dog and its safety, allowing it to return alone? Why would she have taken the dog with her in the first place if she intended to run away? If she had planned to run away, wouldn't she have changed her clothes? Those questions and others like them prevent the Constantines from agreeing with the police, who have classified her as a runaway. It has been 1 year since the mysterious disappearance on July 11th, 1969. During that time, a 13-state alarm turned up nothing. Detectives worked on the case with no success. The FBI had no information. A personal letter from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, expressing his regret, is in Mrs. Constantine's bulging file. Dozens of letters were written to hospitals and organizations all over the country. Their replies, all negative, are filed neatly in a large envelope. From a San Francisco hospital, from the Canadian Red Cross, from Judson House and Greenwich Village, the replies were always the same. We regret that we do not have any information regarding the whereabouts of your daughter, or words to that effect. Although the Constantine family does not believe that Cynthia ran away, they have explored that possibility. They have contacted numerous organizations, spoken to policemen and social workers in the village. William told us that he and his mother reported Cynthia missing to the police, and that there was forensic data obtained on Cynthia, even though 1969 was long before the advances in forensic science we have today.
A detective up here in Mansfield Police Department, state police, there's dental records. They should be in the original report. You know, we had our fingerprints taken at the Suffolk County Fair, my sister and I. They came and they took fingerprints off stuff that she had in her room. I don't know if they lifted anything good. When we were doing getting our DNA taken, my mother and I, that was back in 2011, maybe. Like I said, there was a time before that, way back when I was still on the island in the 80s, when a detective came and they were opening up 10-year-old missing person cases, and they came to my house in Bellport. We backtracked where my sister had walked. There is a detective that contacted me recently, and he's on the case. Like I said, I haven't been back there in a long time. Last time I went to Long Island was 2016 to visit a friend. I didn't really take much notice of Oakdale. We drove through it just to look at the old house that I lived in, but anything else, we just kept on going.
There was one last piece of information that William shared with us about a strange phone call he received. and that he hoped it would finally lead to answers.
Yeah, one thing that comes to mind about phone calls, we had somebody from Oakdale call and say they had information and blah, blah, blah. And I tape recorded it with my recorder when they were talking on the phone. And the police ran it down. And it was just some nut job trying to get famous, I guess. I don't know. But it turned out to be nothing. I know I contacted a few places, contacted news stations, and I contacted missing persons TV shows, but they never wrote back to me. And from 2000, only that time that I probably contacted a missing person organization, and we did the DNA right here in PA. Oh, there was somebody on Facebook who was a retired detective that was his daughter was a friend of my sister's. And he wanted to look into it. I said, go ahead. And I never heard from him after that. But he was in the fire department too. Because this guy, Tony LaBear, told me that Tyler had help in the abduction. And it was somebody from the West Sable Fire Department. But he didn't know who, or he didn't say who. Everybody who was involved at that time were probably either in the 90s or passed on. People that live there today probably don't even know about it. There was an Oakdale webpage, somebody doing historical things about Oakdale. And I mentioned my sister on there, and I think he put the article in there.
So what happened to Cynthia Constantine on that fateful walk she took on July 11th, 1969? Cynthia was well-versed in the routes and trails she took, and William believes she made it at least part of the way they usually walk together, because of where he found the cattails that appeared to have been dropped. Cynthia was known to collect cattails to bring back home with her, to give to her brother or parents. But on this day, the family dog returned home alone, unable to tell anyone what it may have witnessed happen to Cynthia. Was she abducted by one of the people William was suspicious of? Why did so few reports come in after Cynthia disappeared? As if she really did simply vanish into thin air. Would she have gone with someone she knew? We know that there were several serial killers who killed in the late 60s and early 70s in the northeastern part of the U.S. Is it possible that Cynthia was a victim of one of them? We don't know much about Cynthia's story, other than what William, her only living relative, remembers from so long ago. But we believe that someone out there does remember seeing or hearing something, and that her case is a solvable one. William holds out hope too, as he is now 70 years old and still wondering what happened to his sister. At the time of her disappearance, Cynthia Dawn Constantine was 15 years old. She had long blonde hair and blue eyes. She was approximately 5'3" tall and weighed around 115 pounds. If you have any information about the disappearance of Cynthia Constantine, you're asked to call the Suffolk County Police Department at 631-852-6110.
I know what he looked like. He was a white man. I still have a picture of his face in my head. But I got a feeling that this Tyler knew that the dog was gentle, because I don't know if he visited my father's shop. He might have, because he had kids. You know, my father fixed bicycles then. He might have brought his kid's bicycle here to get repaired. So I don't know. I was into my own thing back then. You know, I didn't pay much attention to what my father was doing in the garage half the time. I would go in there whenever I felt like it, and you know, I learned a lot of stuff, but as far as how many customers he had, I don't know. And we got down probably, I'd say, about a quarter of a mile from where the railroad bridge was. That's where I heard the call for help. Now, that wasn't too far away from Tyler's building. So I don't know if he had her in that building and she screamed out the window and they shut her up. I don't know, because it was hard to tell where that help yell, that scream for help came from. It sounded clear as day. It was very clear. It sounded a good distance away, like maybe 300-400 feet. And we were about that far away from that building.
That brings us to the end of episode 356. I'd like to thank William for speaking with us. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and review. Follow The Vanished on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus on Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app. Please support us by supporting our sponsors. By supporting them, you help us offer the show for free. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be covering a case from South Dakota. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.